This is Robert Greenall. This is Robert Greenall. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And good day, everybody. Glad to have you aboard. And as always, with our live show, I'd like to extend an invitation. If you are so inclined, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find a link to the chat room. We've already got Paul and NEC there standing athwart the quarterdeck to welcome you on board. And that's the perfect place that if you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, or even some questions you would like for us to bring to our guest over the next hour, it's the perfect place to do it. We'll both be monitoring during the course of the show. And I also like to put out the altar call there. If you don't already, whether you're with us live or even if you're getting us on the podcast, if you don't already, go over to iTunes, Spotify, Spreaker, wherever you get your podcast, find the Midrats podcast and go ahead and subscribe to it. That way we will be there for you, perhaps at a time more to your convenience if you can't make us on the live show on a regular basis. And on today's show, we're going to dive into a topic we've touched on a lot recently, because as people look at China and they look at the developments in the Red Sea, there is an issue that keeps popping above the background noise, and that has to do with the U.S. merchant marine and our maritime industry, especially with some of the – we saw these issues come out in the latest budget proposal by the president. And if people are policy and policy-shaped decisions, then you get around to asking the question, why would a nation like the United States of America – wind up neglecting what really should be a core sector, not just of its economy, but really its strategic advantage, given that its location and its industrial capacity. And of course, we're talking not just about military, we're talking about our civilian maritime industry. And our guest today, we're going to use his recent article, you can find it on GCaptain, in addition to a few other locations, titled The Urgent Need for U.S. Maritime Reform. The guest and author of that is William Cahill. He's the president of Applied Maritime Sciences, a maritime technology and strategy consultancy, but he's really a Coast Guardsman at heart. Will, it's great to have you on Midrats at last.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much for having me on, and also thank you for what you do. I think Midrats and your daily drumbeat of bringing some strategic thinking and logic to maritime and national security affairs is more valuable than you can realize. And I've been a fan for years, so it's a delight to be on here with you guys to talk about an issue that does require urgent attention and that I'm very passionate about. And also thank you to the fantastic team over at the Boyd Institute who offered me the opportunity to put pen to paper on some potential policy options and how we can bring America's maritime approach into a more competitive mindset that is framed for a renewed era of great power competition, rather than continuing to hold on to things that don't seem to be working very well.
And I like this, the fact that it's not a short article, but it's not too long. I stripped out all the graphics and everything, and it printed out to about 5 pages, very digestible, but it's got a lot of issues heavy. I probably won't touch on them all in the next hour, but that's okay. We'll try to hit the broad points. But when you look at trying to improve our nation's situation and perhaps repairing errors of the past while looking at what we need to do for the future, you need that creative friction, that argument, that critical thinking and critical feedback on how we're doing things to make sure that we're not static in collecting dust, that we continue to improve things. And I think it's like the third and I mentioned this a little bit in pre-show, and so I want our guest, this is coming up, because it really did kind of tickle that part of the brain. About the third sentence of the article, you brought up a two-word phrase that I think it's really powerful when you look at it. And it when you hear it, if it doesn't make you internally at least think of two or three more questions, you need to go back and read the three sentences again. And it's a phrase, policy neglect, and first thing that came out of my mind, and you actually addressed these in part further on in the article. It's policy entitlement, policy inertia, but that's just what came out of my mind. For the listener, because I think it really does frame a lot of the arguments and a lot of the things you point out later on in the article and really address broader issues even outside the article. How do you define that policy neglect and how it manifests itself in this topic?
Yeah, great framing. And let me start out with a little historical context. Like if you go back in time and you look at our first really kind of cohesive national maritime strategy, there was a lot of goodness in there. And I would say that's the Merchant Marine Act of 1920. And if you look at the preamble, and I'm paraphrasing here, it is necessary for national defense and the proper growth of its foreign and domestic commerce that the U.S. have the best equipped, most suitable vessels to carry the greater portion of commerce and to serve as a naval auxiliary. And it is the policy of the United States to do whatever may be necessary to develop and encourage the maintenance of such a merchant marine. And in the making of rules and regs and the administration of shipping laws, to keep always in view this purpose as a primary objective to be attained. So that was written 124 years ago, and it sure doesn't look like we've done that. That's pretty righteous stuff. So if we can figure out a way, if we're going to actually treat the sector in a Mahanian fashion where we have, you know, a robust domestic American maritime sector that serves as a naval auxiliary and provides the workforce and dynamism and competition to allow the U.S. to connect and trade competitively globally, we need to actually have a maritime sector. We have some scintillas of a maritime sector, but when you compare and contrast that with what's taking place in the world, where we have, you know, over 50,000 deep draft, self-propelled, ocean-going vessels that are moving 80% of global trade, so over 50,000 vessels, and how many have an American flag? About 175? I mean, it's just mind-blowing when people hear these figures. Like, how is the U.S. not really part of that ecosystem? That's a market. It's a market we're not really competing in, with a few exceptions. And it's coming home to roost. So we basically need to look at what works. So we see that, you know, it's been great to see Secretary Del Toro discussing some new options and kind of looking at this through, you know, more strategic lens. And, you know, you saw the recent study that the Chinese shipbuilding industrial base is over 230 times as expansive as America's. I think that's probably not much of a surprise to most people who have been involved in the sector for a while, certainly on the policy front. But what does this matter? What can we do about it? How should we go about it? And we could kind of see the playbook to some degree through policy lens when you look at competitive maritime nations around the world. And one of the things that they have in common is constant turn of their policies and a constant evolution, constant flux of taking an assessment of what's actually working, what's required to be competitive, and how do we adjust to maintain a position of market authority and power and maintain the industry. And meanwhile, in the U.S., that's not what we're doing. So that was kind of the premise for the article, because we've been effectively neglecting the necessary policies to develop this critical strategic industry.
Well, what are some of the factors that have restrained our merchant or maritime industries from developing as we believe they should have?
Well, so an interesting historical context to that is there is at least a century worth of GAO and various other studies that come up with the same conclusions, because we've actually been pretty far behind for, you know, basically ever since the antebellum period. America was absolutely dominant as a shipbuilder and a true maritime nation leading up to the Civil War. And we built clipper ships, you know, the most beautiful, capable sailing vessels in the world. And then we kicked off the Civil War. In the meantime, the Brits invented steel iron hulls, steam engines. We, you know, a bunch of Northeast ship owners flagged out their vessels to avoid getting them sunk in the war. We passed laws to prevent them from coming back in because that was traitorous. The war ended, steam power had taken off, we didn't have any ships, and the appetite for wood and sail was a lot less because the world had evolved. And we've basically been trying to play catch-up ever since. So we've had a couple fits and starts, you know, between, obviously, Liberty ships are often referred to as, you know, an indication of America's amazing industrial base, and we turned that on pretty quickly. It's pretty amazing what we pulled off on that. But that wasn't really a commercial play, and that fleet quickly dissipated away. There were laws passed associated with that. We had similar buildup towards the end of World War One, so we've had a couple surges. It doesn't look like we can replicate that now. We've been basically sitting back, and it's become just such a hyper-politicized sector that now every decision is focused very locally on how many jobs specifically in this congressional district rather than kind of the fate of nation. Are we a maritime nation or not? And that's what we need to decide.
Yes, I think it's also telling how much of a knock-on effect the fact that we don't sustain much of a maritime industry here. And you could almost look at the same thing for, you know, you mentioned the United Kingdom, is it has a knock-on effect on a lot of industries. There was a very frightening chart that I saw a couple of weeks ago that had all of our precision weapons that everybody says we need to build more of, and it traced out the supply chain of where the material came from. And if we engage in a war west of the international dateline, we're not going to have access to those sources anymore. And you get down to the point that I guess we'll be looking for as many surplus dumb bombs as possible. But we still have a few blast furnaces here, but the UK is shutting down their last blast furnace. And I may be using the wrong term, but we had one last remaining plate 10 mill, I believe it was in West Virginia, that is now shutting down. We lost the ability to mine lead here about half a decade plus ago. And it's part of the challenge we have in maintaining our industry is we've made a mistake that other nations have not made. And, you know, maybe this is the time to talk about subsidies or tax incentives, but that we've lost the realization that the demand signal that comes from a sovereign shipbuilding industry doesn't just give you better control over your goods that travel at sea, but it also reinforces a lot of very strategic heavy industries that once they disappear, you can't recreate them in any short period of time.
Yeah, that's great framing, Sal. The maritime sectors are absolutely an enabling industry. And there's an interesting piece recently about how, you know, China has been working up the value chain of shipbuilding and is now starting to build cruise ships. And cruise ships have so many components. They might have 2 million components in a cruise ship, and there might be 4,000 different firms that supports. And the type of knock-on effects of having that demand signal within a nation's economy has pretty strategic implications. And it's interesting that you mentioned steel, because that was kind of the impetus for my work on this on the associated policies when I served on the National Security Council as director for strategic planning. I was in the strategy office helping having a small part in helping write the 2017 National Security Strategy. And, you know, our main focus was basically reorienting a whole of government approach to confront China's economic aggression and kind of see it clearly. And it was interesting because the president was very focused on bringing back some of these industries like steel and aluminum. And what we had uncovered in my office, my boss was a hedge fund guy and a nuclear physicist and had his own Bloomberg terminal and started looking at commodities and was like, whoa, there's something here with steel and metal. Like, what's going on here in the U.S.? And as it turns out, we've shifted a lot of our steel production in this country from oxygen blast furnaces to mini mills where we melt down scrap metal. Because basically we've run out of a lot of the veins up in by the Great Lakes where you would be pulling taconite out of the earth. It's just not as productive as it once was. A lot of China's steel is coming from Australia and other parts of the world being shipped in. Meanwhile, we have an abundance of scrap metal, which is a much more economically viable production method for steel, because with an oxygen blast furnace, you basically have to be at 90%+ utilization to be running profitably. And if you don't have the feedstock to do that, you don't have the proximity to energy, energy costs are high, a lot of factors there, versus a mini mill where you basically, it's like a large rheostat. You can adjust the amount of feedstock and power in and steel out. And so you would think that this would be something we'd be really good at. And it turns out the U.S. is the number one exporter of scrap metal on the planet by a significant margin. This is, my numbers are a couple years old, but I think we're around 20 million tons a year of scrap metal that we ship out of the country. And the next highest is either Japan or Germany at about 7 million tons. And guess who buys that scrap metal and melts it down and turns it into capital assets and shipyards and ships and infrastructure that gives back for a century or more? Well, not people that like us very much. And so why do we ship all this strategic commodity out of the country when we should be turning these supply chains inwards? And it turned out that part of the reason was we couldn't get the scrap metal to our own coastal mini mills because we don't have any Jones Act bulkers. Zero. So we don't have that type of ship. So there's a limited amount of scrap that moves in smaller slugs and, you know, rail and barges and inland waterways to some degree. But a lot of the heavy stuff that basically congeals in major coastal areas and gets shipped out because it's much cheaper to sell it and transport it that way than not then turn it back into the U.S. production, we just can't do it. So that kind of opened up this whole aperture of like, whoa, what's going on with the U.S. fleet and the fact that we don't really have one? And then how does that impact U.S. production in all these strategic industries?
Yeah, I think you touch on the Jones Act, you touch on some of the other laws impacting us, and I'm looking at the effect of some of the NIMBY stuff where people don't want large steel mills in their neighborhood. They don't want, these non-ecological things being around. I mean, I know I was at Hunter's Point Naval Shipyard, and I know that left a lot of debris. I know Mare Island Shipyard. We had all these government-run shipyards. We're down to very few at the present time. You know, it's not just this is a long way of saying it's not just the maritime laws that are impacting this, but there's a whole host of other reasons. Some of this stuff was bracked out of existence, or just nobody can afford to do the studies to justify putting a new shipyard, say, into San Francisco Bay.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Mark. What we saw is a significant factor in mitigating the development of coastal maritime heavy industries is real estate near the water is just expensive, and it's going to go to the highest bidder, and often the highest bidder is going to be very politically connected and is going to get, is going to want to have some beautiful condos on the water, something that produces high ROI. And it's tough to compete if you have a proposition to expand a shipyard or even a port or any of these, coastal heavy industries. That's an absolute challenge, especially in a democracy where capitalism-based, where ROI is a factor. But it goes back to, the fact that we need to decide as a people, are we a maritime nation? Does it matter? And then we need to have policies that set up the capability to allow that to flourish. One of the places, for example, that we were identifying as a really good candidate for a new shipyard would be Puerto Rico. If you look at the economic profile of Puerto Rico and you look at the geographical, if you look at trade lanes basically going from Panama Canal to anywhere, you're going through this American island that's literally called Rich Port and has very little port activity and very little maritime activity and has optimal year-round weather for shipbuilding and a workforce that is largely unemployed. There's plenty of opportunities to line there to make a big deal on new shipyards. And there's all the reasons in the world why we should be looking all over the country to find, especially in special economic zones and areas where we can build the necessary workforce over time and partner with allies, we should be building more shipyards. There's no question that that would be a smart move.
I like to bring up to people where they talk about, well, you know, I don't care what Erica used to do, you know, it's too hard, we can't get there. It really can't be, because let's go right on the edge of living memory, 1945 to 1950, right after World War II. The United States stood athwart the entire planet as just a powerhouse. So now maritime industry was beyond a powerhouse. It was unassailable. And there were nations such as mainland China, we called it back then, and especially after the Korean War, South Korea, which was completely destroyed. If you look at what the RAF and the 8th Air Force did to the port of Hamburg that I was at a few years ago, that was completely obliterated, and then they took the obliteration and shredded it. However, when you look at today, very, very high standard of living, high tax, high income, Hamburg, and then you work down from there, South Korea, and in China, they had these incredible shipbuilding businesses. That had to do because of focus and policy. Are there some things that we could learn from the Germans and the Koreans and the Chinese in their rise that we could use as a benchmark if we make the decision that we want?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, again, the playbook is in front of us. You know, that's been the biggest challenge for growing American shipbuilding has been that the CapEx is just untenable. You know, typically building an equivalent ship with the same design and same components, you know, domestically in the U.S., you're looking at 3 to 5X versus international market rates. And often that is, you know, what is often blamed is, hey, we have a higher standard of living, we have higher wages, it's just, you know, they've got subsidies and the list goes on. Well, the fact is, if you actually compare apples to apples on wages, U.S. shipyard wages are lower than Korea and Japan and Germany. And so how are they doing it? And what it is in part, it's dramatically higher productivity. And so if you look at what the Japanese have been doing with high levels of automated laser welding, what the Finns do with amazing icebreaker technology with explosion welding, large plate dissimilar metals, these are things that are largely anathema here in the U.S. There's a lot of political inertia against things because it's often seen as a threat to jobs. But pretty soon you don't have any jobs because you don't have an industry. And it turns out a really good way to be uncompetitive is to not compete. And so we do have opportunity and I would say a mandate here to turn on some policy solutions. And we look at the amount of money that gets poured into silly things that we can't point a finger at what it accomplished. You know, it's mind-boggling that, like, money is not an issue. We are a wealthy nation. Yes, we're running crazy deficits, but let's at least get something for it. And if we're going to be a maritime nation, then we need to put some more resources towards that. But we have to do them in smart, performance-based, accountable forms of support. They can't simply be, well, we can't point to where the money went, which has been a large part of what, when we have had a little bit of this, you know, subsidization, it's really tough to point to what we're getting.
Well, let's suppose we went to Charleston, South Carolina, where the shipyards, I mean, the dry docks are still there. They may be commercialized right now, but is it possible for some great tax policy in your mind to come in and say, okay, we don't want to subsidize you, but we're going to open the gates so you can employ people, we'll train people, all that stuff to build the ships, and then we have a Merchant Marine Academy, and in fact we have several of them around the country. Are we just training maritime officers that have no place to go except to work in the offices of Marriott or on some MSC ships? Where are all these people going?
Well, they certainly aren't going to sea. And the ones that do are often having, despite graduating with unlimited credentials, are often having to serve as able-bodied seamen to do their time for the union before they can join as an officer. And that's you know, when the barrier to entry is that high, where you're producing these arguably national assets of these trained mariners at our state maritime academies and merchant marine academy, but then they can't get a job in the industry. And I, you know, they're MARAD's pretty cagey with the data on, you know, what percent of graduates from the maritime academies get underway. You know, we could track that with strategic sealift officers, and there's some level of fidelity with that. But you know, we don't even we don't even know how many merchant mariners we have. Evidently, you know, there was a merchant mariner working group study a few years back that's often cited by policymakers as, hey, you know, in a full-scale strategic sealift, enduring kinetic situation, we're going to be about 1,800 mariners short. Now, if you look at that report, I would say that was largely samizdat in the NSC, because we actually did some analysis, and a lot of that report didn't make much sense. The sad thing is we don't know how many we have. We know at the Coast Guard Credentialing Center how many credentials are produced, and that cited in the report, it was something like 30,000 more unlimited credentialed merchant mariners than the Merchant Mariner Working Group says. And they said, well, that will require additional study to figure out the delta. So if it's a, is it a 30,000 surplus or is it an 1,800 deficit? The fact that we don't know how many merchant mariners we have, and the fact that we send out, you know, MARAD sends out periodic surveys to say, hey, are you still active, or would you mobilize if you wanted, if we needed sea lift? And it, like, I could tell you, China is not rolling dice on strategic mobility. The U.S. needs to get its, we need to figure out what we require, you know, mobility capability requirement study, what do we require of the auxiliary merchant fleet, and then if it's a strategic imperative, we need to fund it, we need to make it happen, because that's not what we're doing.
Yeah, it's always amazed me, you know, here we are, a nation of 330 million with our, pretty much our own continent, with our Canada being America's hat and Mexico being our mid-skill level production floor. We're very blessed. And yet you have other nations like Norway and Denmark that have, what, 5.5 million population, but you do see them heavily in the maritime arena. And they historically, unless you want to throw the Vikings in the mix here, they don't have any more of a maritime tradition than we once had. And we are, in many ways, in controlling our own destiny. People are policy. Policy directs a nation. And we really shouldn't be able to blame anybody but ourselves when we look at what other nations are doing. And you use another phrase in your article that I kind of liked, because it tickled my my optimistic cynicism in a way, is you called the K Street Abyss. K Street, most people listening here know that's the K Street in D.C. where a lot of the lobbyists are, that are keeping us where so many of our laws and regulations are from the 1890s and the 1920s and the years in between, not within living memory. Who's paying who to lobby for what in K Street that has dug out this abyss for our maritime industry?
Well, let me just first say that K Street is doing their job, right? I mean, they're doing a damn good job. Like, they're doing a damn good job of what they're, you know, the folks that are paying them and saying, whatever you do, prevent change, man, they're winning. Now, that has significant negative impacts to our national strategic competitiveness. But, you know, I had an interesting discussion the other day with a buddy on the Hill, and we were discussing kind of some of the themes of the piece I put out and some of the discussions it's churning up. And, you know, he said, well, so, like, what are the solutions? Like, what do we do? And I said, well, what's the goal? We have to start with the goal. And he said, well, that's easy. It's marginal improvement over the status quo. And I said, dude, that's what got us here. Like, we are so 230 times the shipbuilding capacity of the U.S. in China. Like, how is that acceptable? 10,000 plus merchant ships, often with party members on board and dual use capability of the SIGINT collection. And what do we, like, how is this, the it's so far behind, we are so far behind, it's such a big gap that marginal improvement over the status quo never gets us there, not even close. And I would argue, and I think I mentioned in the piece, you know, one thing I haven't really seen articulated is we're kind of dropping the ball as allies. We're not a very good ally if we're not pulling our weight. We do so much in multilateral and international operations, and I mean, we're pulling, you know, pulling the cart in so many ways. But when it comes to maritime, we're not pulling our weight here. And we our allies deserve better. America deserves better. And a big part of the challenge is K Street's really good at doing their job. And these guys get paid extremely well. And the money that gets spent on lobbying to prevent change is really attractive money for politicians, because it doesn't matter which party you are. All we ask is don't do anything, and we'll max out your campaign. And you can go into open secrets and you can map this all out. And I saw it play out in every discussion when I was on the NSC. You know, once you get up to the cabinet level or so in discussions, well, what does Legiferous say? And then that's where things kind of fall apart. And so you'd have these ridiculously strategic, ready-to-go solutions. And then you get to the principals committee level, and it starts falling apart on anything maritime, because what does Legiferous say? And Legiferous is answering often to their next employer over on K Street. And anything maritime, no change. We can't do change. That's too scary. You know, so that's something we have to resolve for. And I think part of it is just this education piece and having these discussions and not really vilifying anyone. I mean, again, this is what we know. Like, this is everyone involved, you know, the various carriers, the Jones Act carriers, the Shipbuilders Council of America, American Maritime Partnership. These guys are all, they're doing their jobs. This is what they know. But we need to, as a nation, decide, okay, like, are we gonna accept this? Or are we going to swing for the fences here and actually do the right thing and build up a maritime capability? Because it's not certain that during a wartime economy that we're going to be able to summon international assistance to keep our domestic supply chains going. So we actually do have a true demand signal for having a viable domestic maritime sector, not to mention the obvious dual-use purposes.
Yeah, I seem to remember that post-Desert Storm, after some of the fiasco of getting shipping to get stuff to the various ports in Saudi Arabia, that we once again went to they said, okay, we're going to build up our capabilities, our sea lift capabilities, and we did for a while, but now all those ships are, good gosh, they're 30 plus years old, and we're not seeming to be able to replace them. And we've got all these, obviously, the laws. The Jones Act law is under a lot of debate. Is it time to take a look at that and change it? I know in your article you talked about that, but, you know, talk a little bit about why we keep thinking we're going to do something, and I guess maybe it's K Street. Once you start doing something, you can't, if it goes too far out of hand, then they have to reel it back, because it would be too big a change.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts. So you mentioned Desert Storm. There's a great Transcom paper called, I believe, So Many, So Fast, So Far, and it's a kind of a monograph retrospective on the logistical operations. And there is just amazing amounts of great information, super insightful on the sea lift side. They're very revealing about where we were in 1990, 91. Where we were arguably in a much better position in terms of being a dominant hyperpower. And so you can imagine, 30 plus years later, our fleets, had the domestic or our U.S. flag fleets half the size. You mentioned the Ready Reserve fleet is 30 years older often. We have the world's largest steamship fleet, which is the Ready Reserve fleet. The RRF is the, 46 or so auxiliary MARAD-owned vessels that MSC would turn on with a five-day, some of them have a 10-day readiness alert, basically, to get underway and help provide strategic mobility. Now, the challenge is, we had a turbo drill a couple of years ago where basically unannounced some of the vessels have to get underway to test out this capability, because the rest of the year they're just sitting there with a skeleton crew that's basically trying to keep the thing afloat. And something like 40% of the vessels couldn't get underway. So again, you know, we're our model's not working. We're rolling the dice on strategic mobility. That's something that we need to figure out and get serious about, rather than just continuing to admire the fact that, as you mentioned, there's always going to be like, okay, we got to get serious about this. Like, oh, we got to be. I think part of the challenge is, what's the demand signal? You know, what's the, so there's a strategic demand signal that's obvious if you're a TRANSCOM combatant commander, for example. It's clear, like, what are we going to do here? And then you have, there is an alliance. You know, we're not going to go it alone, God willing. But we owe it to the Republic to be able to have the capacity to move into theater and sustain operations, because if we don't, that war comes home, depending on the – I mean, that's not acceptable. And we have this amazing geography that has, you know, in traditional warfare allowed us to avoid that to a large degree. That is quickly getting neutralized. And we need to have the shipping capacity to maintain not only sea lift but also domestic supply chains. And just to give you an idea of how woeful the current status is, as I mentioned before, we have about 170 some odd U.S. Vessels or ships. And part of the challenge here, there's a lot of sleight of hand. You know, often when you discuss with industry reps and lobby and MARAD and others, oh, well, we have 30,000, you know, we have this robust ecosystem. The Jones Act has provided us this huge domestic shipping fleet of 30,000 vessels. But you start looking into it, it's like, well, 25,000 of those are unpowered barges. Got a couple thousand tugs. Got, how many ships do we have? The thing that actually can move bulk commodities and provide, you know, back to that preamble, the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, where it actually talked about moving ponderance of American commerce. Like, how do we get to that? Can we get to that? And part of the challenge is that it's the fleet has basically retreated into only the supply chains that can support the extreme costs. And again, if you have a CapEx for the domestic side of 3 to 5X, and then you have an OpEx of operating U.S. flagship that's about 300% of market rate for the rest of the world, how do you compete? You can't compete. And so that even is reflected in our domestic supply chains, where if you look at the Jones Act fleet, which is about it's about 90 or so ships right now, and you break that out by deadweight tonnage, by application, something like 80% of the fleet is product tankers. So you can basically track out the economics of, well, you know, that's a highly inelastic good. Regardless of price, people need energy. And so we can ever so slightly beat out, you know, foreign imports on, you know, west coast of Florida importing finished product from Gulf Coast refineries. Well, so it's the most inelastic possible supply chains that support these things. And so what we end up having is a fleet that is not the most well-equipped and suitable for moving American heavy industries. And anything that's manufacturing, any manufacturing that is transportation intensive is very, will thrive in an environment and an economy that has complex supply chains or can facilitate complex supply chains, including maritime commerce. And there's a great infographic of an Airbus, I think it's an Airbus A320 being built in Europe, and basically breaks out where all the various components come from and how they get there, what the modal shares are. And a lot of it is various types of maritime transportation. And so if you can't replicate that in a country, then you don't have that industry. So there are significant impacts to what industries the U.S. can support absent having strategic mobility for the economy.
That's a great lead into a question that I really wanted to get to on today's show, and you set it up for it, because and we've talked about it a lot here, and I love talking about logistics to get the other side of the international date line, or, you know, what it's like to chug at 11 knots across the Atlantic to the far end of the Mediterranean on a shallow boat. But, you know, let's look internally here. Everybody should get a globe. If not, get a paper chart, or if you have to, just bring up Google Earth. And one thing that the good Lord has blessed the United States with is the Mississippi River. And we have improved an already good interior lines of communication by water, by, for instance, the intercoastal waterway. And one of the first things you learn in Logistics Economics 101 is the most efficient way to move items is by water, then after that, rail, ground, then air. However, you brought up an example that really kind of set me back, and I went, that's a perfect example of the problem that we have, is globally in the energy marketplace, the United States is one of the powerhouses when it comes to liquefied natural gas. But in spite of that, and in spite of our blessing of natural and improved waterways, we've got a little problem with our own huge energy product. Talk a little bit about that, the LNG paradox that we have intentionally inflicted on our economy, how that operationalizes.
Sure. So the other mode of transportation that kind of beats everything when it comes to energy is pipelines, right? So that's like in an optimal system, you would have pipelines probably for just about everything, you know, whether it be a Hyperloop or it's a traditional pipeline. But pipelines make a lot of sense, and we have this ridiculous situation where we're the number one producer of natural gas on Earth, and yet Americans are the only humans on the planet that are not allowed to buy American LNG. And so that's a challenge because we don't have pipelines everywhere. We don't have nearly enough pipelines to what's called Pad 1A, which would be New England. So we've got, you know, 20 million or so people up there with very restricted pipeline energy access, retiring coal plants, retiring nuclear plants, increasing the demand for natural gas, but no way to get it there aside from shipping it in. And so, you know, you've got, and I mean, it's mind-boggling that we're really good at this, and we have LNG export terminals as close as Maryland and Savannah and along the Gulf Coast, but we can't move LNG to ourselves as an economy because we don't have any Jones Act compliant, so we don't have any U.S.-built, U.S.-crewed, U.S.-owned, U.S.-flag LNG carriers. And LNG carriers are on the spectrum of vessel build complexity would be very high, very challenging for a number of reasons. You have 170,000 cubic meter cryogenically cooled prismatic tank. You know, that's not just something you can build from scratch from the ether. You have to have an industry that already does that or slowly build it if there's a demand to do that. So, you know, that's a number of challenges for us if you have, on occasion, Russian product coming in to the U.S. economy at very high cost to keep grandma from freezing during a polar vortex, and then the same vessel loads up with American Freedom molecules at very low cost and then goes off to somewhere like Pakistan at one-third the price. And so how does that make any sense? And part of the challenge there is when we tried to address this specific issue in NSC 45, you would think we pushed grandma off a cliff, God forbid, an attack on that. Every challenge that we tried to encounter head on and come up with pro-American solutions that were strategically grounded on the maritime side ended in shouting matches over the Jones Act. And so that was quite insightful. And, you know, what we had been working on was the ability to waive navigation and inspection laws specifically for this challenge and in a manner that would be accompanied by building the domestic industry and sunsetting the waiver as soon as the U.S. had the capability. And in the meantime, the waiver would only apply to allied-owned, allied-crewed LNG carriers, which preserved slots, billets for American mariners. Because lo and behold, when you don't have that type of a fleet, you don't have mariners trained to operate that type of fleet. So perhaps it would make sense to knock out all these birds with one stone and in the process make some of these LNG projects down off of Venezuela that have Xi, Maduro, and Putin fingers in them vaporize because we could supply our own energy rather than depending upon operations down there that currently provide American LNG, which is, again, baffling. But as a result of that effort, I believe there were 4 to 6 pages of new language in the 2020 NDAA, basically eliminating the executive branch navigation inspection waiver capability, or at least truncating it to the point where it's impossible to use. So again, that was my K-Street story for this one.
Yeah, as an old oil and gas company lawyer, the pipeline problem into New England is caused by New York. They have vetoed having a pipeline go up there. So you'd
it's
think
a NIMBY
thing. Yeah, it is totally NIMBY, and what we talked about earlier. But we can talk about that for hours. What we really need to do is get to some of your solutions for the mess we're
okay.
in. And you've listed some in your paper, and I don't want to read them out loud, but you kind of run down what we can do as you set out in your paper. What can we do about the mess we got?
Well, so again, you know, one thing we can do is look at what works, and we see, you know, there's a couple of different paths here. We see China's gone from, you know, 15 years ago they were kind of a blip on the radar in shipbuilding, and today they're the, you know, 50 plus percent of ships ordered last year were built in Chinese shipyards. And that becomes a strategic problem domestically for us as well, because we even have U.S. flag carriers constantly spending money in Chinese state-owned shipyards, which is baffling as well, because with the money they save, they then, you know, throw galas to basically – it's wild. It makes no sense. But we should absolutely have a prohibition on U.S. flag and Jones Jap shipwork in Chinese state-owned shipyards. Like, that's number one, very easy solution on that. Let's stop paying tribute to the Chinese maritime sector. So a couple things. We need to look at what works from a holistic perspective, and we need to attach comparative advantages and leverage those. One thing that's going to be, I think, really big and that we're working on in my team is applying some nuclear logic to the maritime sector. So we have this amazing 71% of the globe covered in water. We have this massive shipping logistic industry and a huge amount of capital decisions in shipping and shipbuilding by the carriers are driven by things like emissions caps from the International Maritime Organization, IMO. The real answer to resolve a lot of these things is a return to civil nuclear propulsion. Now, this isn't NS Savannah. This is advanced generation 4 small modular reactors. There's all the reason in the world why the U.S. should be at the forefront of this. And currently on the micro reactor side and the SMR side, U.S. is years ahead of everyone. So we should leverage that advantage to kickstart American dynamism in the maritime sector. And there's many reasons why that makes sense, but it's a win-win all around. It's a growing strategic industry with one that we need to rebuild. Let's marry those together. And we've got the capital. We've got the workforce on the nuclear side. We can blend those two things in a very smart way, I'm convinced. So another area another solution that makes all the sense in the world is we do need to modernize our various maritime laws. So not just the Jones Act, Foreign Dredge Act of 1906, Passenger Vessel Services Act. We need to look at what is the goal? Are we trying to build national shipping capability? Are we trying to build strategic mobility? None of it's working. How do we accomplish that? Well, one thoughtful way that seems to make a lot of sense would be to work with our allies. And the bar is so low that I believe we could do this in a way that lifts all ships, so to say, and doesn't harm what we have. And we could structure this in a way that does no harm by having basically the price of admission. If you want to enter into the U.S. domestic shipping market, which some of our allies have intimated very strong interest in doing because it's a latent opportunity because it's so undeveloped, one of the options would be then the price of admission is some percent of your fleet needs to be built in the U.S. So there's your demand signal. And also some percentage, perhaps the majority, of billets aboard whatever vessels you admit need to be preserved for American merchant mariners. And again, the bar is so low that anything like this, anything would help. But we need to swing for the fences, and I think this one would have a number of advantages. Now, part of the challenge, as I mentioned before, is if the policy, it's hyper-political. And even if you look into the SEC filings of some of the Jones Act carriers, you look at the 10K risk section, the number one thing for risk of all the carriers is any modification of the law. And this includes partnering with allies, like explicitly. You can actually find that in the 10Ks. And there's another interesting incentive asymmetry here where the next biggest risk is any competition. And that's specifically, that's not just competition from foreign carriers, that's competition from domestic carriers or within one's own fleet. So any increase in capacity along one's fleet reduces the rates. And so that's spelled out. So then there's a disincentive to recapitalizing or expanding fleets, and over time that drives cargo into oblivion. And then you have challenges like that I've never seen articulated but is observable with things like the Maritime Security Program, which is the $5-plus million per haul stipend to basically enroll in VISA, Voluntary Intermodal Sealift Act. So basically U.S. flag vessel, foreign belt, U.S. flag, so U.S. crew, often end of life, would otherwise be on the shores of Bangalore for breaking. But, you know, Hapag-Lloyd or Maersk might be able to eke out a couple more years of operations, and the numbers might work with these stipends. Dangerous if you say subsidies. MARAD doesn't like that. And so part of the challenge is every time that those stipend, there right now it's about $5 million a ship. There's efforts underway to revise that up to $6.5, $7.5, $8.5 million per year per ship. What that does is that drives up, it's the same workforce labor pool for the Jones Act fleet domestically. And so as soon as that, the preponderance of that differential is labor. So 3X on OPEX for U.S. flag, 90%+ of that is labor. It's just what it is. And so when the MSP rates go up, that drives up the cost of labor within the Jones Act fleet as well, because it's the same labor pool that's competing for those belts. So you end up having this disincentive to shipping because it becomes more expensive within the Jones Act fleet every time the MSP increases. So we have to kind of figure out how to square those circles because, again, the intent is good, it's just not working.
And there's also the intellectual competition we have going on. I want to circle back to something and on a not unrelated topic, and I tweeted it out earlier today. Since 2014, one thing that I've just beat my head against the wall, I love the National Guard, I love reservists to death, but I've always thought that while making it incredibly professionally rewarding for your ambitious young officers, that we really should send our best senior O3s, junior O4s as observers to Ukraine, even right now, just to be able to learn and to get a different perspective. And you brought up an interesting idea going back to the Merchant Marine Academies that I kind of like. Talk for a little bit about your maritime Fulbright exchange idea and how you think this could help the larger issue.
Yeah, so absolutely. I think as we've discussed, like the workforce is a big challenge. We have to make the maritime sector, especially seafaring jobs, which you're often away from home a lot. Like, how do you compete? How do you make that attractive? So it's something we need to tackle. And one way to get much better would be across the maritime sector would be to look at our partners and allies who are just knocking out of the park and figure out how to learn from them directly. And you know, the State Department has this great Fulbright program, and wouldn't it be spectacular for this strategic industry if the government could fund Americans going over to our partners and allies with comparative advantage in maritime sector and learning from the best. And I would see this as an expansive program, not necessarily just for people seeking naval architecture degrees or Merchant Marine Academy grads or naval officers. This could be the model of cross-pollinating work, or at least pollinating and coming back, and then maybe there's some type of exchange. Could be expansive for even our ratings and aboard our ships and our maintainers and our shipbuilders. This should be like absolutely happening at scale, but certainly would be smart to start where we have the most control, which would probably be what kind of like what you're suggesting with some of our, you know, top performers coming out of various government-sponsored training pipelines. Let's get them overseas and learn from the people who are doing really well at this. And that, you know, relationships matter. And it's not just the intellectual stimulation and learning that is being brought back, but it's lifelong relationships with people who are really good at this industry that we need to get much better at.
So I gather as part of that, the shipyard concept that we're asking the Japanese and the Koreans to come help us out, I mean, that's a program that would benefit a great deal, I would think, from having our engineers and architects and marine architects and stuff go over and see how they're doing things. And the technology, which you've already talked about, what Finland is doing, what some of these other countries are doing, helping to assemble these merchant ships in ways that I'm not sure we have anywhere in the country the capability of doing that. I could be wrong, but it seems to me that would be a very important thing for our guys to see.
Absolutely. I think it's extremely refreshing to hear the Secretary of Navy go on with developing policy options to bring our allies here to the U.S. to help build our industrial base. And not to mention, there's potentially, you know, if they're thinking strategically, which often, you know, they do, perhaps better than us, that provides some defense in depth of their strategic industry. Because when the balloons go up in Indo-PACOM, you can guarantee that those shipyards, our allies' shipyards, there are targets. So having some defense in depth and building that here in the U.S., would have profound benefits, especially because competition is so low currently. I mean, we only have 3 active shipyards in the U.S. building vessels over 100, you know, ships over 150 meters. Like, we're not building any ships, you know, certainly not at a meaningful rate. So there would be all types of reasons why it'd be beneficial to us. Perhaps a little more difficult to articulate why it's beneficial to them, but there are reasons. Again, the defense in depth one would be particularly strategic. Now, there is a little bit of cognitive dissonance when we have, you know, announcement about U.S. Steel being bought by Nippon, and then there's a lot of political furor over, hey, well, you're taking away this American industry. Well, but can you come over here and build ships? You know, like, there's a little bit of dissonance there that we need to reconcile. But we should absolutely be able to look at all of the commercial industries that we're thriving in, have massive international supply chains. You mentioned earlier that some of those are going to be put to test if China decides to make it challenging for us. So we need to keep that in mind as we build this this early new partnership. And part of the challenge too is, you know, a lot of the steel for shipbuilding that's imported is coming from China. A lot of the vessel components are coming from China. Thankfully, engines, high propulsion systems, often coming from Northern Europe, some Korean firms. But the shipbuilding and what little limited shipbuilding is taking place in the U.S. is already backed by significant international supply chains. But somehow we're still, again, 3 to 5x as expensive using the same components and everything. So we have to address that with productivity enhancing investments.
Amen to that. It would be nice to have a little bit of the sparkly stuff that you see in other places that within living memory, their shipyards were nothing but mud banks and reeds. And Will, we have reached the end of the hour, been a great fast hour. For the listener, if they wanted to keep track of you, where's a good place for them to keep an eyeball? And do you have some other projects that you're working on that we should keep an eye out for?
Yeah. So, thanks. That was, I feel like we just started getting there. We didn't even get into the ports issues. Plenty of work to do on all that. I'm mostly active on LinkedIn. Not really out there on the socials other than that, but I find that to be a pretty, pretty potent, venue for some cerebral activity. And the main thing my team's working on right now is figuring out ways to accelerate, the development and partnerships and regulations necessary to set the conditions for a lot more American dynamism in the maritime sector, particularly leveraging our growing nuclear advantage. And then I would say We're also looking at things like artificial intelligence, robotics at sea, and perhaps some advanced manufacturing offshore, including shipyards. So stay tuned.
Well, I know Paul actually asked about AI and shipyard and ships earlier on in the show, so maybe we could have a conversation later on that when y'all get some work done on it. Thank you very much, and I hope you have a great spring.
Likewise, pleasure to join you guys, and thanks for what you do.
Yeah, thank you, Will. It was a good show.
Right,
and we appreciate everybody joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope you have a great Navy and Coast Guard day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.